From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation with geostrategic analyst and senior lecturer from Moscow State University, Mark Sloboda, for a view from Moscow of this past week's midterm elections and the apparent admission by the U.S. Secretary of State of the intent of the U.S. to commit a crime against humanity by starving the people of Iran.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
All our pleasure.
Why don't we start with a postmortem from the U.S. midterms,
yeah.
At least as seen from the outside.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. How does it look from Moscow? Because it looks pretty crazy, right?
Yeah, it looks pretty, first of all, it has to be said that the structure for U.S. elections is awful. And we've heard that, you know, in comparison to multiple countries at this point, between voters being purged partisanly from voter rolls, third parties being sued to be kept off the ballot, polling stations closed, long waiting lines, problems with machines, incompatibility from state to state, this 50 states holding different elections, all using different machinery, all under different conditions. The process of the elections themselves looks like a mess.
Yeah, it sure does.
And people would not believe that in Russia, all elections here are fake, according to, the dominant meme about things are done in Russia.
Yeah, well, an election in Russia, you have a piece of paper with one box in it. You have to check it, and there's a guy with a gun that follows you into the booth, right?
Yeah, well, two guys with guns, just in case the first one is unreliable.
Gotcha.
With all the questions about previous Russian elections in the last 10 years, the Russian government has really gone to great measures, clear voting boxes, video cameras that anyone can access online that cover every voting station in the country. No black box voting for one thing. It's all done with paper which prevents the raising of questions with black box voting and other things like that.
Yeah, but also,
no waiting lines, no broken machines, no stations closed.
Right.
Everyone in the country, can easily vote with their place of residence.
Right.
I've voted here. Just for the first time last year, but I've been to voting stations. I've been an observer at voting stations here before. Really, it's much better organized. There's much more personnel involved. It's usually done at local schools, and most of the people conducting the elections are school teachers, right? Those infamously Putin. Putin cronies, the school marms and everything. It's a shame, from the news that we see, about huge lines and people, not going to vote. And I know from personal experience the mess it is for expats to vote who are out of the country. And in most cases, their votes aren't even counted then.
Right.
Unless it could really statistically, change the effect. It's almost never done.
In
Russia, like many other countries, if you're overseas, you simply go into your embassy or consulate and vote, and that's it. And it's not this back and forth registering and voting by mail, and it's a mess. The whole system is a mess, and a lot of it is and also the day, you know, that, that it is conducted during a work day, during the work day. You know, there's, it's not conducted on the holiday, on the weekend. It's not a holiday. It's, you know, there's no federal rules about allowing people to go to vote. It's a mess. And it's done, you know, of course, in order to reduce the number of people who vote.
And that works because less than half do.
Yeah. So, that said, we did have pretty good turnout for this election.
Yes.
Yeah, particularly among for a midterm election, particularly among youth, minorities, women, there was pretty good turnout. So it's higher than in previous years. I mean, the final tally isn't in yet that I've heard as of speaking, but it is definitely over the recent years of 39-40% for midterm elections.
NPR said it hit a 50-year high at more than 47% voted.
47%. Okay. So almost half of eligible voters, right?
Yikes.
Yeah, well, it's better than 40% of eligible.
That's correct.
Voters,
that's true. Yeah.
So, yep. So considering that 2014 was one of the lowest years for midterm elections in recent memory, so I saw that a huge number of voters, you know, over 2/3, turned out either way with a strong opinion about Trump being their primary. So in many ways, it was a referendum on Trump. I think that is a fair characterization of this election, and people were voting, you know, down ballot party line, pretty preferably. So that reduces the it increases the parliamentary party effect,
right?
That they see in you know, in parliamentary systems, you know, rather than the ability to vote for a, you know, an individual candidate, which I thought has always been one of the strengths of the U.S. elections,
or a policy, since the parties in essence have abandoned policy as a platform. Yeah.
I think more policy almost gets done via referendums, and there were a few,
that's right,
you know, significant referendums, you know, on different state ballots, and that's something to be said, at least, I guess. You know, as for the results of the election, you know, it again, Trump, you know, the Republicans gained slightly in the Senate and lost significantly, but actually in line with a standard midterm. I mean, it's a truism of American politics that the sitting president's party, you know, usually does poorly during midterm elections. You know, call it, you know, the U.S. Citizenry need to balance powers, if you will, or just a simple counter reaction with turnout. But there was no huge blue wave that I saw. There was no, you know, Trump's approval rating is hanging around 40%, little plus, you know, a little minus. Right. But, you know, with the archaic U.S. voting system, you know, gerrymandering that you really saw in effect in this election and so on. And, you know, the simple rules for the Senate and populations and everything. We see that, you know, geography gains a certain advantage and rural states, which, you know, tend to generally be Republican, you know, outweigh their more populous urban counterpoints. And we saw, I think it was up to 7 million more votes nationally, of course, went for Democrats in the Senate, but the Republicans won the Senate race.
Right.
And that's simply a result of the U.S., you know, archaic voting system. So, you know, the Republicans, you know, took advantage of it. That's why Trump won the election, you know, again, because of this geography over sheer population. Some people's votes count more than others in the United States, sometimes many more. And that, you know, that's simply the way it works. And, you know, you have to plan your electoral strategy accordingly. So, you know, there was a few significant. We saw Mitt Romney, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts. Don't ask me how that ever happened. Become a senator
from Utah.
Ted Cruz, yeah, of Utah, and a Mormon carpetbagger.
Right.
Ted Cruz nearly held on to his seat. We saw
he owes that to Trump, by the way, which is an interesting little dynamic. After all of the theatrics at the RNC, he'd be out of a job without Trump.
Yeah. Either way, he swung around and showed that, you know, that party over principle or something like that, I guess. We saw the long expected election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as a supposedly young minority left wing congresswoman. How exactly left wing she is, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, remains to be seen. And we can expect challenges, of course, for Nancy Pelosi's leadership. I would hope there's at least a challenge, to centrist business as usual as the Democrats take over, but and fights for various committees. So what's awaiting the Trump administration with Democratic control of the House? Nothing good. Nothing good.
I agree with that.
First of all, their legislative agenda, such as it is, I'm not sure that Trump really had a legislative agenda that I could identify. And Paul Ryan, stood down himself, which is almost unheard of, particularly for someone that young and so on. And I think primarily it's to disassociate himself with Trump, but I could be wrong with that.
Yeah.
The legislative agenda probably is dead. So I sum it up, three ways. Gerrymandering plus geographic polarization equals gridlock. Three G's right there. And that sums up the election. And so gridlock. I mean, that's nothing new. Both Obama and Clinton had hostile Congresses for most of their presidencies. So that, that's actually the standard order of business in Washington. So nothing. Right. The one thing that seems to generally get, cross bipartisan support is imperialist foreign policy and military spending.
Yeah, no kidding.
So those are the two things that only really tend to get done during this type of hostile Congress.
And so far, that's true. That's what happened. I mean, when even with Republican majorities, when they did the military budget the first year, Trump said, "Here, let's have this increase." The Republicans said, "Yeah, we'll do that." The Democrats said, "No, have that increase plus this." And
yeah.
They actually threw more money on top of it.
Yeah, we'll double down on that.
Right. Know? Yeah.
We're more warmonger. We're more the party of war than you are. There seems to be a competition these days.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when it was that the Democrats became the party of war. I guess it started during the Clinton administration and escalated from there.
Yeah,
certainly during the Obama administration. You saw it with Hillary Clinton's campaign when Robert Kagan and the neocons came to support her. But, you see it all over the place now. I see figures, Thomas Friedman talking about, despite having supported the Iraq war, these neocons are actually pretty good people. I'm like, well, that's a condemnation of you more than anything else.
Right, exactly.
Two parties of war for the two parties of power.
Let me ask you on that, because while you're on the neocons, this is something that I did a couple of interviews myself the last couple of days, and this is something that hangs in front of me. You've got Trump saying, he hasn't been able to actualize it, who knows what the reasons are for that, whether it's his own lack of motivation or being constrained by events in politics here. But he wanted to reverse the neocon direction, the regime change thing and all that was bad, and he wanted to, get a better set of relations with Russia and China. And, we see resistance in the form of he has the Helsinki summit with Putin, and they want to put him in, not just in prison, but execute him for treason over this. He gets accused of being a traitor and everything else. Whatever he might have planned to do after the midterms were settled. With the Democrats in control of the House, they are in control of impeachment, if they'd like. Nancy Pelosi said, well, we won't impeach unless the Republicans want it, but it's not hard for me to envision a Republican holding a press conference and then Nancy Pelosi having a ham sandwich impeachment vote 10 minutes later, and now he's impeached. It goes to the Senate. Well, right now, they're going to have Republicans somewhere between 51 and 54 members, depending on how some of those races shake out. So yeah, the Democrats have 40-something plus two. The two independents will vote with them. And that's not enough for the two-thirds necessary to remove him from office. But nested within the 51 to 54 Republicans are many, many, many neocons.
So if
Trump decides to make a play for any or all of these things, a peace treaty with Korea, maybe even with Iran, new business with Russia and China, do the neocons and the Democrats remove him?
Yeah, I mentioned the exact same thing on Crosstalk on Sunday.
Great minds.
This potential. Yeah. I mean, it's true with the split House and the, you know, Republicans controlling the Senate, that nominally, you know, the Democrats can't impeach Trump. I mean, we have to remember that impeachment is a political process,
right,
not a legal process.
Right.
But this is a neocon gun to us. I mean, the neocons already have control of right, the administration's foreign and military policy, Bolton, Pompeo, right, you know, and others. I've even heard rumors that Mattis is considered too mad. The mad dog, the guy who said that, you know, be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill every single person you meet, and that it was fun killing Afghans, you know, during the 17 long U.S.
Wow.
war there, the longest war in U.S. history. But he may be too restrained, too right, peaceful for them. So they're talking, at least talking about getting rid of him for someone more, you know.
More man.
You know, despite Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, ironically, we heard the same thing in the first campaign from Obama. We heard the same thing from George W. Bush during right, his campaign about a more restrained, inwardly focused foreign policy. We heard that right, again and again, and we heard it with Trump strongest actually speaking out against regime change and U.S. Mess with right, Syria, supporting jihadis and everything. And how awful and what a waste of it. And the exact opposite is turned about right now. Unlike Obama, we have extremely, moving towards conflict with Iran. You know, that is, you know, I believe that is on the table for the next, 2 years. They're definitely making a push towards conflict with Iran. Tensions with Russia are actually worse than during the Obama administration, mm-hmm, despite his campaign rhetoric. You know, how much he's responsible for that, and, you know, how much has been right, enforced on him, you know, politically, you know, by the neocons, so a deep state. You know, I don't know. Maybe he simply became, you know, doesn't have a strong real view about this and became convinced the other
whatever
way.
It is, that equation just changed for the yeah, worse, though, right?
Be it sanctions, pulling out of treaties and everything else, there's no question that the Trump administration has done far more against Russia than the Obama administration did. The idea of improving, you know, relations with Russia is completely gone at this point. We actually have increased tensions with China because of a tariff war and, you know, sanctions on allies and everything. You know, generally, I mean, we're not yet at war in a new country. We're not bombing a country that we weren't during, right, any more countries than we were at right, the end of Obama's administration
right,
or yet. You know, knock on wood there. The new U.S. policy in Syria is that we are permanently militarily occupying the country until we get the change of government we want by economic and political blackmail now instead of overt regime change. And the Syrians aren't allowed to ally with the Iranians and aren't allowed to have any Iranians in their country. That's the other the other caveat there. And, it seems like in many ways, U.S. participation in, you know, the Saudis' genocidal war on Yemen has increased. and the, you know, the whole Hasagi affair has demonstrated, you know, what is the life of one Saudi journalist slash former intelligence asset, you know, compared to the cost of human lives in Yemen, which is, you know, actually better estimated. I've seen it, you know, at a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah.
We're looking at now when you count in the you know, deliberate starvation deaths and so on.
Yeah.
But
I mean, we've had, I remember reporting back in like 2016, 2015, that there were something like 9 million people that were, you know, days away from starvation. And so I don't know how many people have fallen off since then, but it's a lot more than they've been reporting here, I'm sure.
Yeah. And the Saudi Arabia is really deliberately depressing the numbers, right, and making sure that reports don't get done at the UN, right, using the heft of their money, their money and influence, as they are in Washington, of course.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, foreign policy wise, things look bad. And, you know, the Trump administration is with the Democratic control of the House is facing, you know, not just the potential, at least for impeachment, whether it becomes a reality with neocon defection if he tries something foreign policy wise, or simply political theater before the next election if it's decided they need to bring that up again. And even if they don't have a chance to pass it, they could bring it up simply to, you know, to create outrage, you know, generate more hysteria about him. It's kind of cynical, but, you know, but these things happen. You know, also, investigations. You will see House investigations yin yang. You will see subpoenas. There will be a flood of subpoenas across Trump administration. They will try to put everyone under oath until they say something stupid.
Right.
You know, as we saw with Flynn and Papadopoulos, who didn't actually do anything except lie to the FBI.
Right. Perjury and obstruction.
That weren't illegal. and it hit them with an obstruction of justice.
Right. Or perjury.
I don't know if the Mueller investigation itself will go away. We don't see protests against wars in this country anymore, but we do see protests against continuing this. I'm sorry, it's a witch hunt, you know, with absolutely zero evidence of Trump-Russia collusion. But we got Manafort on back taxes. So, you know, I guess, you know, that is supposed to be what the Mueller investigation was about, right? Back taxes on foreign, you know, profits, and it's
right. It's not a witch hunt, but we threw Flynn in the water and he floated, so we drowned him.
Yeah. So in new investigations, we'll see investigations into, you know, sexual allegations of harassment and misconduct. And God knows there's enough of those. I think there's some 19 at this point.
Right.
We'll see investigations of Trump's finances, demands for his taxes. We'll see investigations over giving his son-in-law Kushner a security clearance and a top advisory job, you know, ethics investigations. We'll see all kinds. So subpoenas, investigations, hearings, we'll be flooded. And then, you know, of course, you have the legislative agenda dead and the potential for at least the theater of impeachment, if not something more substantive.
Speaking of theater, there's going to be some entertainment value in the investigations, because now that he has secured, and with the Senate, he's going to secure the appointment of a new attorney general, the Department of Justice, you're going to start seeing the investigations go both ways. You know, the neat thing about Washington is, wherever you aim subpoenas, you're going to find criminal activity. And so, you know, I mean, if you put 100 senators on the stand, sooner or later, you're going to be able to perjury trap or obstruction of justice trap each one of them, because they're all up to something no good. And Trump is going to be able to do dueling investigations now, and that's going to be a lot of entertainment value.
Well, he could have before, but it wasn't done.
I think Sessions wouldn't do it. I think that was the real source of tension.
Was that the real? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's possible. I mean, they could have been launched from the House.
Yeah.
But Paul Ryan didn't. And I thought that was a mistake, a tactical mistake, Trump administration. You know, the things that Manafort came up, well, you know, we saw enough with the Podesta brothers that they're doing the exact same sort of thing and so on. That wasn't done in the House, and now it becomes a lot harder, I think, actually, with you know, the Democrats certainly won't be launching any House investigations into their own members.
No, but DOJ can do it directly. That's
Department of Justice. Yeah, we'll see. You know, Trump will have to get a attorney general through Congress, and, you know, that won't be easy at this point.
He has the Senate, so I mean, it's an advise and consent position. I don't think he needs the House.
He doesn't need the House, but the political, impetus, you know, will be, very strong against anyone that would be seen as providing too much assistance to him.
That's true. So let's go to this thing with Iran and Pompeo.
Let me just wrap up there. What I wanted to say is that what does Trump have left then? Right. Of course, he has the Senate, and judicial appointments. We'll see an acceleration of that probably because that's done via the Senate. So we'll see a lot of federal judicial appointments. We'll see focus on that. We'll see executive orders and an attempt to legislate via executive orders, which Obama did. And we'll see, I think, even more of that with Trump. Of course, he won't be writing it, but, you know, someone will be. The other thing is, you know, military and foreign policy and actually foreign policy, you know, and the position of commander in chief are actually the primary powers of the presidency, not domestic politics. But we often see that it's only when presidents are denied advancing their domestic agenda with a split Congress, we see presidents then shift to become more focused on foreign policy to be doing something. And I think that is what we'll see here. So you see a little bit of both. Looking at it from, a Russian perspective, well, on one hand, it might be good if the U.S. is consumed with gridlock and get nothing done. Has vitriol back and forth, between the two parties of power. On the other hand, presidents do tend to get more active overseas when they're denied their domestic agenda at home. So we don't. It could go either way. From that perspective, I mean, that's the perspective looking, from the outside. It's a mess, and the U.S. government is a mess, and the parties are a mess, and the political trials in Washington are a mess. Let's hope that they focus on the mess and not on foreign policy. That is an out that that could be provided. And we recently already saw Trump cancel an expected meeting on the side of Paris summit. Coming up next week on the memorial of World War I. Anniversary of World War I. So Trump already canceled a scheduled sidelines meeting with Putin there. So that, that doesn't look good already. So Pompeo, Trump's new Secretary of State.
Yeah, we've got a minute. So
the CIA. He said Iranian leaders will have to fall in line if they want their people to eat.
Wow.
Talking about new U.S. sanctions on Iran, or rejuvenated sanctions on Iran. And I'm like, as awful as that sounds, at least he's actually admitting what every U.S. administration is trying to do with sanctions.
Right.
Which is punish the people of a country enough that they then create instability, and the hope that, their governments either fall in line with U.S. policy or then toppled, because of, deprivation of the population, basically. And Pompeo is honest about that. So every time the U.S., someone in the U.S., including Pompeo, claims to speak in the interests of the Iranian people or the Russian people or the Chinese people or any people out there that the U.S. is sanctioning. Remember this quote: if they want to eat, their leaders better do what the U.S. Tells them to do.
And what it reminds me Madeleine Albright starving 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it. Yeah. Mark, thanks a lot.
Sanctions are bipartisan.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you very much, Mark. We'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.